Hello.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. Thank you very much for your kind words and follow-up and additional responses to the questions that I sent around. I'm very impressed with the degree of sophistication and how much you guys have reflected on and already thought about some things that we're talking about and going to talk about. So I will incorporate every one of the questions into a discussion. Are there additional comments or clarifications about anything we talked about last seminar before we move into our topic for today? I couldn't have been that clear. Anyone have any additional thoughts or questions that you've thought of since last seminar? If not, we'll move right
in. Dave, I'm sorry. It's Carol.
Yes,
I just want to ask a quick question. How are you?
Great. This is?
Carolyn, sorry.
Carolyn, okay, I'm super.
Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm great.
So today we're covering, I know that you went over some material last week, but I just want to make sure so that I follow along. What are we doing seminar one today, the wellness, the power of story, premise of the wellness story, or are we moving to number two? That was last week, okay.
Yes, that's recorded. It should be posted. The recording should be posted by the next day, certainly in less than 24 hours. The IT guy, Bill, will be on that to post it. So
it hasn't been posted yet, right?
No, it's posted. It should be posted. I haven't double checked, but it should have been posted.
Yes, I took it.
Okay. Yeah. See, the beauty of that, mm-hmm. you can fast forward over a bunch of stuff. You know, I'm not known for the things I espouse: clarity, brevity, simplicity. So you can just fast forward over a number of things, but.
Well, I think because I registered late, Dave, I did not get it. So if you wouldn't mind, that'd be great. Thanks.
Just a second. If I wouldn't mind what?
Getting it, the post, because I didn't.
Okay.
It didn't show up in my email.
This is for you, Carolyn, and for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The link that you received when you registered has the outline and the workbook to download and print. It has the four places where the recordings will be posted. And for seminar one, go there and click and listen to it. Is that clear? So everyone that registered got that link to the page. I sent it also in my welcome letter like a couple of hours before. So if there's any confusion about that, let me know. Or if there's any technical problems, let me know too, and I'll direct you to the person for that. Any questions about the material or anything that you want to discuss about what we've talked about, or additional responses from anyone about those two questions? And thanks for all the things you sent in after our seminar. Anything at all to discuss before we launch?
Hi, Dave. This is Elda. I have a more of a comment / question about the material we'll be covering today, and I was very excited to see that we'll be going deeper on how the brain acts with change and neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, because those are all areas I'm very, very interested in. And in particular, I'd be interested in hearing, based on your experience, if possible, I don't know, now or at the end or over email, in terms of sort of the length of the duration in kind of changing or creating a more helpful pattern. Now, I know that can be something practical, where we're talking about a new pattern, or something emotional, such as overcoming a self-limiting belief. And I know there are certain tools that can help in making that happen, such as positive feedback, whether it's from oneself or one others, and kind of taking out optionalities. But any other sort of tools that kind of help create those new patterns, and any insight of what's kind of considered, you know, according to your experience, sort of a timing on creating those new helpful patterns and changing the brain. Thank you.
Yes, the first response to that is as soon as you hang up, you can begin that new pattern in the first 10 minutes. You don't have to wait for some contingency to get comfortable or till the stars align or to feel confident.
Right.
Just begin and do it. You know, I've worked with, I work, as you, each of you probably know, with practicing professionals, coaches, you know, docs, other professionals, as well as performing professionals. And here's where some of the examples come in, performing professionals, actors, others who perform. They, as I mentioned last time, they decide what they want to do. They don't have to be motivated. They don't have to be motivated to go to the gym. They just do it every day. And that creates then a habit. When you think about it, we're going to return to this in the end, when you treat what you need to do in the framework of just something that is a given, like going to work. You don't debate about whether you're going to work every day. You don't feel virtuous if you do. You just do it. So as we've talked last time, that creates the beginning of a pattern. Now, if you want to create change, create a new habit, focus on the system, not just the goal. We're going to begin today to focus on the system of deconstructing, of understanding how we put together stories, how we put together our life narratives, and we're going to focus here on a wellness story. So this is about understanding the algorithms that our minds and brains especially operate on for behavior and attachment and emotional patterns, and looking at how we can go about changing that. Now, that's a process. So the other answer to your question is to create a habit. Doing something repetitively, our brain rewires to create neuronal pathways and networks to make it automatic, to make it the default mode. That takes a while. That usually takes a month or more. Think about if you drive the same way to work every day, after a month or so, you kind of have it down. You can do it without thinking about it. You can listen to a book on audio. But when the pathway is blocked, there's road construction, you have to think about it. It takes energy. So you can't just rely on that automatic mode. So this is about creating an automatic this is about creating a way of understanding the algorithms of what we've come to operate on. And 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious, so there's a lot to understand, but it's all very doable. So the good news is that the more complex behavioral patterns that, you know, like the ones that take 21 or 31 days when you repeat it, the ones that are more complex, if you revert back one time, it doesn't mean you start all over again. It just means you recognize, self-correct, and move ahead. And some patterns take several months. The more complex connection, behavioral, and attachment patterns. So listen for more of the answer to that as we look at the seven-step process, the acronym with the roadmap, and that's what we're going to be dealing with for the next for these three seminars, this seminar and the next two, to really look at understanding that. And that, I think, is going to be very, very useful to looking to create a way to just to listen to your own story first and then to your client's story, to look at how to go about helping co-create a new story. And once you know your own story and have worked on that, it's way easier to do that with clients. And this is simply, this is not a directive of what to do. This is not a prescription of if he says this, then you say that. But it's a way of really understanding how we create stories, how our minds and brains work. And for listening to that in our collaboration with a client to catalyze change. So listen to it from that perspective. As you're hearing a story from a client and co-creating a new one, but first, probably, the best and most effective work would be to really understand your own story. So as we go through these seven steps, and you'll see exercises and work tools in the workbook that will facilitate and catalyze this that we will not have time to go over, but I wanted to include it because it will be a useful aspect, and this is how it'll be helpful for you to do the work ahead for what we're going to be doing this week, to have gone through those work tools and exercises to see what you think about them, to see if it's already begun to perturbate some things, to create some questions for you, for the automatic story that you've been writing, to break the script, in other words. If everything always fit according to what we think it should be, if the script were never broken, we would never learn. We would never grow. It's only when the script is broken. And that's what we do professionally with our clients. We are story busters. We perturbate a system to look at things in a different way and do that collaboratively so that together we're co-creating something new and different and partner with a client in doing that. So hold on to, or jot down any other questions you have, and we'll come back to them.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, and we're not done answering it, as you might guess. So hold on. Okay, we've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. We're going to look more closely now at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change. How many of you know how to read or write code for your computer? These seven steps are a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. It's a system of understanding and a stepwise change, integrating psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching. This is about understanding the algorithms of how your brain works in the constructing of the default story. So we're going to look at these seven steps in the next three seminars, the roadmap for a new wellness story. And again, this can apply to any story, money, relationship, career, anything. We're going to apply to wellness. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map the strategies, author new experiences, and program new wellness identity. Each step is simple, but it's certainly not easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about our lives, breaking bad or outdated habits, developing new ones, remaining disciplined over the long haul. So in this seminar, we're going to look at the first four steps. These steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself, then your clients. So, step one, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Now, remember this premise. Each moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us. They're created by us. But the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know because it seems to just happen, to just be the way things are. Insights, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. This means that you have to take 100% responsibility for your life. So, how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? So, and this again is in your outline, so you can follow along without having to take a bunch of notes. There are four principles in recognizing authorship, this first step. First principle. Our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Let me give you a simple example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to move on to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant has to stay in the area determined by the length of the rope. Now, fast forward. This elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, over 6 tons. It could easily break that same rope, but it doesn't, because earlier, as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by its assumption based on earlier experiences, and that small rope used initially is still the one that keeps that elephant in place. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle 2. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. We construct our storylines from these premises, these beliefs. We have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they actually work currently. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect, because we always make our beliefs come true. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. Remember the story of the two anthropologists. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Principle 3, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists have discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people, for example, were asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. If you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates 35% within the following 3 months. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking people if they intend to work out, eat certain foods. So, state your intentions yourself. Be specific. Write them down. The stated intention is most powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. You're putting it in the output channel. That makes it a complete circuit in your brain. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and confer causality, whether or not it's accurate. There are a number of research findings that illustrate how we find something to make sense of what we perceive and believe, even if it's not cause and effect. These findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but whenever they're asked for a reason, they'll readily give one because that creates a closure. So to complete, a story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. That's why for so long, when physicians didn't know what was going on, they said, well, this must be the flu. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth. It's a finish without an ending. So I would suggest review the exercise in step 1. Recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.5 of the workbook. And look especially at the definition of plot and storylines. And Again, I'd suggest you complete each exercise in step one before moving on to step two. So let's look now at step two, own your story. And I want to highlight the exercise here, assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. It may help you get a better idea and perspective of some of the things that just seem so automatic. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we process daily, like adding a new diet or a health club membership, is likely not going to have an impact unless you change the software. Just adding something doesn't do anything. You have to disrupt the pathways and the behavior that's so automatic already as a component of adding something new, or there's no place to put it. As we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think might be useful for you in coaching. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. If there's something about your performance that you want to change, look at the antecedent, the behavior that leads to it. If there's a behavior that isn't working or that you want to change, look at the antecedent there. What's the belief that's driving that behavior? This is a simple way to deconstruct this otherwise default mode. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to work out 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs also influence behavior and reality. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Every one of these, in my view, is a coachable moment or sentence or phrase. Now, notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So first you have to experience what you do as a choice rather than just the way things are. This is about recognizing ownership, the first step, recognizing ownership of your story. Whatever you think, believe, and experience, it's not there until you create it, even though it seems to just happen. And another way of saying that, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. So if your client is talking about a situation that is uncomfortable or unacceptable, that client is either creating it or accepting it. So you have to have a good working alliance to be able to look together at things that are really uncomfortable, but that's an ultimate piece of collaboration. Now, let's apply that notion of recognition by talking about two components of story writing that I think will be useful to you as you listen to the stories of your clients. Point of reference and active versus passive. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They transfer a responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here are some typical characteristics of those who have at times an external point of reference. This is another way of saying these are each coachable moments. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They feel vulnerable to the responses of others at times. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They may focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They may see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Or whatever they have done habitually, they refer to it as if it were part of their identity. I'm a procrastinator. And that brings a closure in their mind, not exploring it further. Although it's not cause and effect, it's a label, but it serves the purpose of closure. That needs reopening. That needs perturbating. Now, contrast that with those with an internal point of reference, something you're coaching toward, who see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. If experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. That's kind of one of the most basic things we think about in coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. And people pay you for that, actually. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they realize the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion. To recognize and listen to active versus passive position. This comes across in how someone constructs their sentence, but it tells you a great deal about how they view themselves vis-a-vis their own authority. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. And remember some of the examples in a related way that I mentioned last time. My anxiety stopped me. My doubt paralyzed me. A passive position, as if what the person creates then acts on them as if they're the victim rather than the author of it. So these are all coachable moments. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, once recognizing and owning your wellness story, the first two steps, step three, assess the storylines and plot. You'll see two examples, two exercises in your workbook, 1.12 and 1.14. For some clients, this is about the only kind of tool that I use, but I will send them these two exercises. Distinguish and address ideals and distinguish and address needs. These are part of the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. They reveal so much because when someone has a clear picture of their needs and ideals, and I do too, so I will write down inside the folder for that client, the top three needs and the top three ideals, and refer to them as we're collaborating to look at their strategies and goals and the ones we're created to be sure they're in alignment with their needs and their ideals so that all of them is going in the same direction. And when they do, it's dynamite. Part of the assessment of your wellness story is to understand storylines that don't really go together, that are conflicted or contradictory. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. So a paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. And we're often not aware of having them. We just assume that we see things the way they are. So here's a simple example. The brain can be of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's set up an exercise program and plan a savings program as well. Well, the limbic system is, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HD TV. Each struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. One of the unique quality, and this is where we come in to look at plans and to look at these components of writing a story. One of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from the experiences of others as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them and examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all of the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot? Now, as a sidebar here in coaching your clients, they are not seeing this as a story. They're not seeing what they're doing in their life as a story. This is our metaphor to talk about it, to listen and to understand and to find ways to communicate it. What they're doing, that's just the way things are. Story is the metaphor we use to look at how we can understand how they're structuring and creating their life in a better way. So, another aspect, listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person or group or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Another component, listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary, prerequisite to assessing changes. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious will likely be attributed to fate. You are always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or not. So it's important to know exactly what they are. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan, a system, stepwise, of how to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Now, we'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization. And there's a visualization exercise in the addendum, a scientific way to go about creating a vision in a structured way, and the same with affirmations that are the story to support the visualization. The visualization is about rewiring your brain. The affirmations are about revising your mind software. So listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says it's not a full commitment. It's an out, a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. Now think about it. You know the words of somebody who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When someone says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. So build an accountability for yourself and in your client by asking, by when? And what are the steps? The by when part, the SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end for time if it weren't time specific. Now, the SMART goals are on page 3.4, but we'll get there. So listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it, feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well at the time, especially later. A huge, delicious dessert will taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last way longer in time than the immediate pleasure of the great taste. Plus, 80 to 85% of the pleasure of the taste is in the first three bites anyhow, so you're wasting it after that. Also, reflect on how that redundancy, your body has already accommodated to the sensation, can make a difference as you plan ahead and create a system. Listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Recognize what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak. When you eat too much, eat foods that are unhealthy, or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. It's a storyline needing to be heard. A symptom repeats until it's listened to and translated. Somatic language is literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. Milrad Pavic said long ago, "It's easier to fall ill than learn the truth, so take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you." So, for us, you are the author, not the victim, of your symptom. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. So, step four, decide what to change. We're going to talk about change and how to do it. Have for reference the first exercise of Module 2, four basic inquiries for storyline evaluation. And then for later reference, maybe 15 reflections to understand your storyline. That's on page 210. So the precept for this step, part of the struggle for people to embrace change, the reason change is so hard is that so many of the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, people don't make changes, even when they know it's in their own best interest. Information does not change behavior. Remember, we talked last time, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, and there would be a lot of librarians who would be billionaires. But information is not a way to change a habit. To change a habit, you need a system, because the system will tell you the next step. So many times when a client perhaps looks like they're resisting change, be sure they know what the next step is, because that's the most common reason that people resist change. Now, the next most common is that our minds and brains oppose change, as we've talked about and as we'll come back to. So, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. As I mentioned about someone calling herself a procrastinator, that is a descriptor, but it's not a cause. It only describes a behavior, so that means we look at that instant of how she decided to stop herself. That is the coaching perspective. And we'll return to that because there are two fundamental aspects of the human psyche that apply there. So let's look at how the brain opposes change. This is crucial to understand when we engage change every day with every client. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or a business story. Let's look first at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate our coaching work. First, in each of these components, these 10 precepts of how our brains work, I believe will help you in guiding someone to write a new wellness story. The principles are very simple, so simple they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for the resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to change behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that have been repeated, that have become habits, the brain hardwires them to make it easy, to make it efficient. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by what we do repeatedly to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about driving the same way to work each day, as I've mentioned before. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. When these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain, where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted. We feel discomfort. Our prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so it opposes, the brain opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said, I heard him say this in a presentation discussion, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And this is from his book also, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Two, the second aspect of how our brains oppose change. Change creates dissonance. So couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information, and it's based on expectation as validation. In fact, when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reacts as if something's wrong. It's an actual location in the brain, very close to the emotional center of the brain. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, the difference between what we expect and what we actually see. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. At times, it can be really abrupt and explicit. Remember maybe the experience absentmindedly going to the refrigerator. You're thinking about what you're going to do later that day to get a drink of milk, and boom, you discover that you took a sip of orange juice. Well, when this happens, neural firings disrupt the expected flow and use brain energy. That's your error detection mechanism as well as your taste buds. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior, in other words. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So this part of our brain also responds to mistake. It gives us feedback for mistakes. So this is important if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and print out to change itself. And we'll come back to that. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. Here's an exercise. Let me give you some numbers if you have a pen. I want to give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Often the answer is 3 and 6, maybe even multiples of 3. Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. This is huge now in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a third rise will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes, listing 2 things, then a third non sequitur, set up, pal. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This can make it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and unbalanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict, envision the right things. 4 of how the brain opposes change. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer, neither. They're both likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And recognition for somebody being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Another simple way to say this is we get what we focus on. And in this example, lateness is focused on, and you get what you focus on. You get more of what you respond to and less of what you don't. Parents have known this for centuries. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do can result in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. I've mentioned this in the example of the pro athletes who get up to go work out every day at the gym. They are not motivated. They simply have a plan and stick to it. That's all you need. If you wait for motivation, it's another way of putting it off. Or if you bargain in some way for a contingency before you do it, it's going to interfere. Have a plan, stick to it. Create a system, know what the next step is, do it. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that can prevent fluid learning and understanding. Alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, or even irritability and impatience shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes, causing them to forfeit optimum functioning. So when emotions get triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. Here's something I think is very important in terms of coaching. The brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. So whenever there's an initial perception, if it's framed as anxiety, that boots up a whole different mindset that equates maybe anxiety with danger, better head for cover. If it's framed as excitement, that's a very different mindset of possibility, exactly what we do in coaching. So it's a way to strategically then move ahead. So the initial framing determines the mindset that, in this instance, goes in very opposite directions. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation almost always as a little bit of stress can enhance memory and learning, but if it's for longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. So this is one of the aspects of regulating states of mind to look at and address that. For each of you, here's what I would recommend for that. We'll touch on this next time, but if you have 30 or 35 minutes, go to the homepage of MentorPath, my website, and there is a free webinar that's about 30 minutes long on master states of mind. And it's a microsystem of addressing self-regulation and state of mind. We're talking today about a macro system. So these are the two major, in my view, systems that can be of great benefit in working and applying the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching. 8, how the brain opposes change. Closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Major factor is not age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as being in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. This, and I see this a lot in family succession of business, people who have had a position, a title, a role, a position in a family, when things shift, it's a huge challenge. So this is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to empathically understand and then collaboratively pursue the strategic move ahead. Now, these last two principles, I'm going to close with these, but these are huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment in repeated studies have about a 15 to 20% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. For those who have increased exercise, physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. The hippocampus, remember, has to do with memory and creativity. Recently, these findings were replicated in non-invasive human studies, London taxicab drivers, and medical students at the University of Hamburg. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus, memory and creativity, decline. Decrease in number with stress. And finally, number 10. Neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. Here's a simple example. For stroke patients who would have a dysfunctional arm, usually, traditionally, the dysfunctional arm was put in a sling so that no harm would come to it. Now, in recent studies, the good arm was put in the sling, so they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing. After as little as 10 days, these patients regained significant use of an arm that, by traditional belief, would have remained useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. In this example, you already know. not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same for a classical guitarist in the dominant hand. Now, the good news here, we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in the brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So, now in conclusion, four things about what neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to a wellness story. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they perceive and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can happen no other way. In other words, you have to begin with where your client is, what their experiences and beliefs are, to then go someplace new. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent. It's an actual neuronal pathway in the brain. What we know is that facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in the brain. So you can't just simply remove it or present a better fact and think it's going to override it or new information, and, oh, yeah, that's going to be an enlightenment. So this is where we come into play, to collaboratively look at and gradually revise that process. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to override somebody's neural network. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's subjective reality, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Here's an example, I think, of an application for this about information. Some penguins wanted to learn to fly. They knew they had the innate capacity because they were birds, but they'd never been able to fly in their life. So they hired a mentor coach. They did an all-day seminar. They collaboratively set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations, did encouragement. After a few hours, one penguin flew a short distance. Others then were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. Okay. What kind of questions or thoughts do you have? I know I took longer than I had expected, but we'll still take a couple of minutes. Thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything we discussed?
Dave, yes, I do have a question. This is Carol, and I apologize for that abrupt. I don't know what happened with the phone, but I got a landline. So okay. You talked about enriched environments, and as you were referencing neurogenesis and the creation of brain cells. So after we had our session last week, I had a client and we were chatting, and I used exactly what you said. But when you began the discussion, you talked about you can't be really effective doing any of this work if you're not willing to do the work yourself. And I have to tell you, this is just amazing for me. It's just amazing because you really have to. It's like holding a mirror and looking at yourself. And in order to help someone else, you have to be able to do that and willing to change the way you think about something. Your mind.
Yeah, like the anthropologist, you have to believe because it will affect everything you do. And once you've done that, you approach it and engage in a very different way. It's kind of a quiet confidence. And our state of mind and confidence as a state of mind is the most contagious thing in the world, faster than the fastest virus.
It's amazing.
So did you have, I think those are great observations. Did you have a question from that I interrupted?
Yeah. So no, you didn't interrupt me, but I was as you were talking, I just realized that you said it earlier, your money story as well as your wellness story, they're all interrelated, and you can't even begin to do this work in an effective way unless you. I call it doing the hard work because it forces you to really look at the way you tell your story and that you have a story that you're telling without, as you pointed out, without the unconscious mind. You know, the storylines might exist in the unconscious mind, but that you, in your day-to-day operations, you don't recognize that that's even probable. And I just thought that was just amazing. And so I really am glad I took this. I'm taking this course.
Yeah, okay, great. Here's a very practical example to apply this in terms of really how can understanding more about the mind and brain sciences apply to strategic coaching. I used the example earlier about procrastination. So rather than creating a closure and no more examination to look at this particular instant that someone stopped herself. So the first question is, did she have a plan? Did she know what next was? If the answer is yes, then let's look at how she decided to stop herself, even though it may not have been conscious. It may have been moved on to something that made it make sense to stop at the time. But the two most powerful forces of the human psyche that are hardwired to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. So if the surface story, remember that's only 5 or 10% of the operating system, but if the surface story is I want to generate more money and create wealth, then stopping herself, if she had a plan, that's the first step. If she had a plan and didn't stick to it, how did she tell herself no? At that instant, there was something that that she activated a fear of something that made it make sense to stop herself. That may not even have been conscious, because conscious and logical was, I want to pursue this. It doesn't make sense that I stopped. I had a plan. This plan seemed to be good. But the stopping herself may not have been as conscious, but when she stops herself, it is conscious. So the question is, what is the fear that came into place? What is she avoiding? Is it being afraid that if she puts everything into it and then she'll be a failure, she'll embarrass herself? Or does she maybe sort of semi-consciously bargain that, well, I think this is going to take so much away from my family and my spare time, or, you know, I don't really have what it takes. But there's a shadow story that stops her. So when the surface story of what she consciously wants and has reasonable positive goals, when there's a shadow story that goes in the opposite direction, she's stuck. So these two components, what we're afraid of, what avoiding pain and seeking pleasure, can be in equal and opposite directions. That's where we come into play as coaches, because this is something that can be examined and looked at, not to go back into the past, but to look at in terms of creating a plan and sticking to it and not letting the fear be sufficient reason to stop, maybe even reframing the fear as excitement. And that creates a whole different mindset going forward. Does that make sense as an example?
Excellent example. Great.
Great. Okay. Well, I know we're over time. Let's do this. Let's plan to add on 15 minutes after seminar 4 just for question and answer, because I want to be sure that after we've been through all of the 4 seminars, that we have a chance to talk, and maybe that would help if there are questions that don't get answered, or things that you think of, or even that don't make as much sense as they seem to at the time. So let's plan. I'll be happy to stay. You don't have to, but I'll be happy to stay 15 minutes after our final seminar. This is 2. We have one more, and then at the end of seminar 4. So we'll pick up right here. If you have questions or reflections, write them down. We'll begin right here next seminar, or if you have something you want to email me, I'll be happy to incorporate that. Okay, thanks very, very much. I appreciate all of your interest and your responses. Till next week.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.